What is Enculturation? Was presented by David Crabtree on August 8, 2005 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Disenculturating the Gospel. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce David. David is going to start us off today with the topic of what is enculturation. So, David Crabtree.
My job is to set the stage for the talks that will be coming later in the week. I need to start out with a definition of enculturation. I've decided not to give a definition of disenculturation because it doesn't exist, but I will give a definition of enculturation. This is one I made up all by myself, so I don't know if it'll work or not. We'll see. The definition I'm going to use is any act, expression, or creation that bears the stamp of the culture in which it was produced is enculturated. So in other words, it's any act, anything said, anything done that somehow takes on the clothes of the culture that has produced it. And I would contend that everything that anyone does that's of any significance, if it's being done by a mature adult, bears the stamp of the culture in which that person was raised. So every TV show that we watch on television in America that's made by Americans, it has the stamp of American culture on it. It is enculturated with American culture. Every speech given by an American president is enculturated with American culture. Every anti-Bush demonstration in America has the stamp of being enculturated with American culture. Even my lecture is American. I can't help it. So that's what I mean by enculturation. In order to talk about acculturation, we need to talk about culture in general. So I'm going to spend most of the time just talking about the phenomenon of culture. I hope that you will start generating some questions, because this is a very big topic. There's a lot that could be said. I didn't know what all to say, and I'm counting on you to write down the questions that come to mind so that we can talk about that further and yet today and then for the rest of the week. I want to talk about why there is culture and then talk about what are the main features of culture. Why culture? We have culture because our instincts are so poorly developed. In the animal world, there are some animals that have highly developed instincts. I'm going to use an example that I know nothing about. It tends to be my want. I haven't seen this movie, but I've heard about the movie. It's a movie about penguins. It's a documentary. And it talks about the penguins and how they have their children, and how the father, I guess, sits on the egg for a long period of time, and the female, the mother, comes back at just the right time when the egg is hatching, and then takes over the duties while the father goes and eats. What's interesting about that is how highly developed the instincts are there. That they know exactly what to do and when to do it because of their instincts. So all of their actions, all of their behaviors, all of their reactions to things, to stimuli, are instinct-based. They don't have to think about it, they just do it. Human beings do not have that kind of instinctual information. Our instincts are not nearly so well developed. We have instincts, but they're vague instincts. I have a friend who works as a nursing, what is she called? A lactation nurse, I think is her title. She helps women learn how to nurse their children. I think that's an interesting phenomenon. If anything should be natural and instinctual, at least in the animal world, in the rest of the animal world, you would expect it to be that kind of thing, how to feed your child. And yet, we as human beings need to have training in that kind of behavior. So our instincts are not very well developed. So, as we come into the world, we have to start making sense of our experience. And so that we can make decisions as to how we act and how we react to things. So how do you do that? Thinking about a baby coming into the world, how does a baby start to make sense of the world and figure out what kinds of behaviors would be appropriate and what kinds of behaviors wouldn't be appropriate? What kinds of values are appropriate and what kinds of values are not appropriate? What kinds of purposes are appropriate, etc.? To start making those kinds of decisions requires a whole mass of assumptions about the world. And our culture, then, is the way that we are provided with answers, those kinds of assumptions that we use as a base of operations from which we can make decisions and figure out how to conduct our lives. The example that readily comes to mind is another one that I have known nothing about, but I like examples that I know nothing about, is a computer. And the only reason that this readily comes to mind is I got a computer early on when personal computers were just starting to happen. And so I know a little bit about this particular phenomenon. The computer, the box that is sitting on your desk, is a very powerful instrument. It can do a lot of things. But it's just potential. If you just turn that computer on, and you don't have an operating system installed in that computer, it doesn't know what to do. You can type on your keyboard, you can move your mouse, you can kick it, you can do all kinds of things, but it does not know what to do. It's really dumb. What it needs is an operating system that you stick in there that tells it what to do with the various stimuli that it receives. Now it knows what to do with a keystroke. Now it knows what to do with the mouse movement. Now it knows what to do with the click of the button. But it has to have that operating system before it knows how to respond to things. There are different operating systems that you can put into a computer. And it seems like every year there's a new one. For a Macintosh, there was operating system 9, and then there was Panther, and now there's Tiger. And with PC, I don't know what they have, Windows or whatever. Those are all different operating systems. If you put a different operating system into the computer, the same computer, it will handle your keystrokes differently. It handles that information differently depending on the operating system that's installed. All of those operating systems are more or less capable of doing what you want to do. Some are better adapted for certain kinds of operations. Some are better adapted for other kinds of operations. So they're different. They work differently. But all of them are capable of, they make your computer capable of doing a lot of different things. Culture is the same kind of thing. When a child is enculturated, it's like installing an operating system. And that operating system then tells the child how to respond to different kinds of things, what to do in different situations, how to think about the world. How does that operating system get installed in a child? Well, the child is born into a family. That family is part of society. And children are born imitators. They just start imitating. They watch, they observe, and they start imitating. And so whatever other people are doing, they pick up those behaviors. How other people are responding to situations, they learn to respond, etc., etc. So they very quickly acquire behaviors, and over time, they acquire values as well that are associated with those behaviors. I have four children. With my first three children, I took for granted the process by which children are enculturated, how they pick up the norms of a society. My fourth child has Down syndrome, and it is very interesting that one of the features of the way he works is he doesn't pick up on those clues as to how you're supposed to conduct yourself. So, for instance, when he was younger, if we went to the grocery store and got our products that we were going to pay for and we got in line, he would stand millimeters from the person in front of him, which became very embarrassing when that person would turn and bump into him or something. He's right there. What's interesting is we had to teach him, consciously teach him, no, you don't do that. We never had to teach our other children. Just by observing, they picked up on those kinds of things. Where do you stand? How close? Similarly, how close you are to someone when you're talking to them in a conversation. That varies from one culture to another. We learn that just by watching other people around us. When you can sing and dance, when it's appropriate to sing and dance, we had to teach our youngest and have not entirely successfully done that yet. But it has been fascinating how many things we have had to consciously teach him that we never taught to our other children. They were just, it comes naturally that we pick up the behaviors from people around us. Okay, so from the day that we're born, we begin to construct this understanding. It's our operating system, this understanding of how you conduct yourself. And attached to that are assumptions about the world. So if I go to someone else's house and it is the common practice, everyone takes off their shoes when they go into a house, we adopt that behavior as our own. And the more universal that behavior is in our experience, the greater our assumption that that is the way that it has to be done. If everyone I know puts ice in their pop before they drink it, then we're going to assume that's the way you drink pop. And the more that everyone does it, the more I assume that's the right way to do it. If everyone that I know prays before a meal, then I will assume that that's the thing that has to be done. And the more unanimous that's done in the surrounding culture, the greater my sense that that's right. That's just the way that it's done. So culture has a huge impact on the way that we think about make our decisions and what we're going to do. It affects every little thing that we do, and we are only minimally aware of that. To a huge extent, we're oblivious to the impact of culture on our actions. The only time, generally speaking, we aren't aware of it unless we come into contact with another way of doing things, another culture. It's when you go someplace else that you see that there is another way to do it. It had never occurred to me that there was another way to do it. And the question comes, why are they wrong? In my experience, when I go to another culture, I go through three phases. The first one is you see how you're struck with how different everything is. Different signs, different kinds of buildings, all that sort of thing. Dressed differently, etc. So it's kind of superficial differences that first assault you. Then the second phase is you go, oh, but under that there is a lot that is in common. You know, human beings are the same everywhere. And then the third phase is, but they really think about the world differently. That's a fascinating, I think that's a fascinating process to think through how people see the world differently. When I was in college, I studied Russian and then I went to study in Russia. And that was an interesting experience. I went with 30 other American students. We went to what was then Leningrad, and we studied there for several months. And while we were studying there, we went on some excursions in Leningrad, and then we traveled around to some other Russian cities. Some of the things that were striking in that cultural experience is, one of the first things that struck me was going into a Russian store. I suspect things have changed now, but during the Soviet period, if you went into a grocery store, there would be very few things in a grocery store. They were very small. And there would be a sample of everything on these shelves, but it's just a sample. You don't take it. You can just look at it. But there'll be cans of beets and cans of cabbage and no meat. There'll be some cereal that they use for breakfast and et cetera. So there'll be maybe 100 items in a store, but it's just one of each. You figure out what it is that you want to buy. Then you go to, you get a slip of paper from the appropriate department in the store that has on it what it is that you're going to buy. You take that slip of paper over to the cashier. You pay for the things that you're going to buy. Then they give you a slip of paper that you take back to the department, and they will go get what you purchased and give it to you. So you never touch what you're going to buy until after you've paid for it. It's a very convoluted system, but it's hard to shoplift. That was a striking cultural difference from our experience here. There was also a striking cultural difference between people, Americans that were on the tour. Regional differences. There were five of us from the Northwest in this group of 30 students from America. And when we would go on a tour of a museum or whatever, we would travel around in this group, and there would be a tour leader that would talk about the various things that we were seeing. But it became almost laughably predictable that two or three of those of us that were from the Northwest would get lost. That the rest of the group would all stick together. But we didn't have that same sense of needing to be in the herd and would kind of wander off, and it became a source of some tension. But it was interesting just to see the cultural differences and compare that with people from New York. There were several from New York. Their cultural distinctive was they expected the highest level of service wherever they went. And if we didn't get service to their expectations, they would very vocally respond, "This, we paid good money for this, why?" And most of the rest of the people in the group said, "We're in Russia." What do you expect? So there are distinct cultural differences that you don't even think about until you come into contact with something that varies from that, and then it comes to your attention. And much of that runs so deeply in us that we can't change it even if we want to. When I was studying Russian, one of my professors was a man in his early 70s. And in Russian, you are supposed to address people, the most respectful form of address that you can use is their first and their middle name. So he was insisting that we refer to him by his first and middle name. And when I grew up, I was taught that you always refer to adults, as when I was a child, you always refer to adults by saying Mr. or Mrs. whatever. You always did that. You never used their first name. So when I was in Russian class, I literally could not bring myself to use his first name when I addressed him. And we had a talk about it, and he gave me a special dispensation. I could refer to him as Mr. Grievanovsky. But it's interesting how deeply those things run, and you can't just turn a switch. I'm not going to do it that way. I mean, it's just part of us. But it's not just behaviors that are transmitted through culture. It's also assumptions about the world and values. When I was in Russia, it was very common for some of my Russian friends to use an expression, an American expression, and then they would just break out laughing. And that expression was, "Time is money." In Russia, that is laughable. I mean, it is. I mean, they have that whole concept that every minute could be used for the production of income. That concept is so foreign to Russian culture that it is truly laughable. And yet for us, that's an assumption about the world. Time is money. Every minute of my time, I have to gauge, is this worth $20 an hour or whatever? Because time is money. On the other hand, there are assumptions in values that you see in Russian culture. I talked about the stores in Russia. The libraries are similarly organized. When you go into a library, when you go into the door of the library, there is a policeman there. And you get a little form that has your name on it and all the vital information. And it's given to you by this policeman. He fills it out using your identity cards to make sure he gets the information correct. Then you carry this slip of paper the whole time that you're in the library. And the library is divided up into these departments. So there's the history department, there's the sociology, et cetera, et cetera. You go in to whatever room you're interested in doing your research in. So I go into the history room. As soon as you go into the room, then you go to the person sitting at the desk, and they sign you in. So it says on your slip at what time you went into that room. Then, if you want any books, again, you don't get to touch any of the books. You just look in the card catalog, and then you go to the desk, and you request the books that you want to see. When those books come, they call you up to the desk, and they sign on your piece of paper what books you looked at, you took into your possession, and the time in which you took them into your possession. So then you sit down and you read them, and then when you're done reading them, you take them back to the desk. They look through to see if you made any marks in them, and then they write on your piece of paper that you checked them in and the time that those were checked in. If you decide to go to another hall, they sign at that desk, you checked out, you left this room at such and such a time. You go to another room and you start the whole process over again. When you leave the library, you turn in this slip. So this slip has on it where you were at every time during your stay and every book that you touched. The value that gets communicated by that is no one can be trusted. The sense that you get when you're there, whether it's shopping in stores or whether you're in a library, is that you can't trust anyone. There has to be bureaucratic oversight of everything that everyone does. So values are transmitted through culture as well as just behaviors. Wes gave me this quotation that's defining culture, and I think it's very helpful. It's all that floating mass of thoughts, opinions, maxims, speculations, hopes, impulses, aims, aspirations, at any time current in the world, which it may be impossible to seize and accurately define, but which constitute a most real and effective power, being the moral or immoral atmosphere which at every moment of our lives we inhale and inevitably exhale. That's culture. So our culture is just a part of us. It is inextricable from us. There's nothing that we can do to be not enculturated. I am an American. Whether I like it or not, that's just a fact. I grew up here. I've been enculturated with this culture. I am an American. Unlike an operating system, I can't change that. Even if I wanted to, I can't change that. I can moderate it slightly, and I will stress the slightly because it is difficult. There's a sense in which we can have upgrades. The culture around us is changing, and our enculturation can go through changes. But I think that becomes increasingly difficult as you get older, and that accounts for some generational differences. So I can moderate that cultural influence on me. I can also be aware of it. I can make conscious the impact of my culture on me. and as a result be able to step back from it and look at it and assess it to a certain extent. But for the most part, I can't change that. I am American. I will be American. There's nothing I can do about that. Okay, what are some of the features of culture? And I've got, I've got six features that I'm going to point out. The first is that culture is dynamic. And some cultures are more dynamic than others. They change constantly. I am astounded at how much American culture has changed in my lifetime. When I think of American culture when I was 6 or 7 years old, it's radically different, significantly different from the culture that my children are growing up in. It has changed a lot. And it will continue to change. It's democratic. And by democratic, I mean everyone has a voice. Everyone has a say in what our culture is. To the extent that you do things that are consistent with the culture, then you are promoting that. To the extent that you do things that are a deviation from the culture, then you are voting for change. But everything you do in one way or another is contributing to the culture around us. Now, everybody contributes, but not everybody contributes equally. George Bush contributes more to the culture than do I. Steven Spielberg contributes more to the culture than do I. Derrida has contributed more to Western culture than do I. So there are people who make disproportionate contributions to culture, but everybody in one way or another contributes to it. But no one's in control of that process. It has a life of its own. No one is able to steer culture. The man in the street is influenced by the media. The media personality is influenced by the thinker. But the thinker is influenced by the man in the street, the one around him. So everybody is being influenced by other people. No one is totally in control of the direction that culture is going. A book that's interesting in that respect is Paul Johnson's Modern Times, where he's talking about, I can't remember now, is it the three people who have had the greatest impact on the 20th century in the world? And one of the things that's interesting in the book is the means by which they had the impact. And it's not always predictable, and it's not always the thinker just having the impact that he wants to have. Sometimes it's an impact that he didn't want at all. So it's not in anybody's control. Third, culture becomes institutionalized. As societies, we want predictability. Unpredictability scares us. So we want to know what to expect from other people. And in order to know what to expect from other people, we want them to be enculturated. We want them to have the right set of values and behaviors so that we know what they're going to do in various circumstances. Any aberrant behavior is disconcerting. So how does society do that? It sets up institutions such as an educational system that encourages and raises children to be enculturated. It enculturates them. Religious institutions enculturate. Laws enculturate the legal system. Clubs, organizations are all means by which society enculturates. So a whole series of ways in which society institutionalizes that process of enculturation to make sure that as many people as possible within the society are taught, are trained to respond in what it considers to be the right way to various circumstances. Culture is historically based. A society has a cultural memory, and that cultural memory has an impact on the culture itself. And it cannot be otherwise. I thought about this with respect to American slavery. The fact that America had an institution of slavery and a large number of black slaves has had an impact on our culture that has not diminished significantly over the years, I would say. That it continues to have an impact on the way that the races relate to each other. And that history is undeniable. It happened, and there is a legacy from that. There's nothing we can do to change that fact. To a lesser extent, I would say the Vietnam War has had a cultural legacy. It has had an impact on the psyche of our nation that will not go away soon. And you could think that all we have to do is erase it from the history books. If we could erase those things from the history books, then it would no longer have its legacy. But the reality is, things like that cannot be removed from the cultural memory simply by removing them from the history books, because there are too many witnesses. Too many people saw it, too much will be said, too much will be passed down one way or another to erase that legacy. After I finished college and after I finished studying in Russia, I eventually made my way to Rome, where I worked with a ministry that was helping Soviet Jews who were emigrating from the Soviet Union and coming to America. And I taught English to them, which was great fun. But I really spent most of my time just talking to them. And this was 79, 80. So still during the Soviet period. And I spent hours talking to people individually. And what most of them wanted to talk about was all of the things that they had seen in Russia that they had never told anybody about. All of the missing uncles who disappeared during the middle of the night. All of the neighbors that disappeared. Anything like that that they had any knowledge of. It was like I was someone, the confessor. I was the one that they were all going to come to and tell all these things that they couldn't tell to anybody else. And I was struck by what a huge impact Stalin's reign had on that society. And even if they weren't talking about it, I'm positive that it affected their behavior and the kinds of values that they transmitted to their children. So even if you could erase it from all the history books, those kinds of events have an impact on a culture. They can't be otherwise. I've been particularly conscious of this because in looking at the Pentateuch and thinking about how God directed the history of the Israelites in taking them out of Egypt and through the wilderness and then into the Promised Land. In giving them that historical experience, he was, to a large extent, shaping their culture and the way they look at the world. A fifth feature of culture. A culture doesn't really have a worldview. It has, and I'm going to use the term that C.S. Lewis uses, a backcloth. In his book, The Discarded Image, thank you. I'm getting old. In A Discarded Image, he talks about the Middle Ages. And he points out that he's not describing the worldview of the Middle Ages. Because if he were to use the term worldview, it would imply that it's systematic and coherent, all fits together, that it's a conscious construction of what the world is like. Cultures don't have that. It's not assembled that way. It's assembled hodgepodge. There are pieces that come from various places. I said it was democratic. It truly is democratic. So there are a whole bunch of assumptions that arise from different places, and those all go together and create the same backcloth. But those pieces don't necessarily fit together. There can be inconsistencies. There can be things that are incoherent one with another. So it's not really a worldview, it's just this grab bag of assumptions about the world And that's what he calls the backcloth. That's why it is that in our times you can have a postmodernist who is nevertheless very respectful of the findings of science. Or you can have a scientist who is superstitious. That those things can be put together because nobody stops to think about the coherence that needs to be there. So the backcloth is not coherent, it's not systematic, because it's not rationally arrived at. We just absorb it. Last observation, it's not monolithic in the sense that there's a lot of room for individualization. A person can be fully a product of their culture and yet express their own unique personality within that culture. I don't know that this has ever been studied. I suspect it has. But let's just do a mind experiment. If we have a set of identical twins, separate them at birth, and they grow up in different cultures, I think what would happen is that to the extent that their personality is genetically driven, that they will have similar personalities. But those personalities will take a different shape depending on the culture in which they're raised. Just an example. Let's say that in the part of their personality is that they tend to be rebellious. My guess is that both of them would tend to be rebellious. But how would that be manifested? In our culture, one act of rebellion is to take up smoking. That's one of the associated significances to smoking. That may be true in our culture, but it may not be true in another culture. So what I would anticipate is the twin born in another culture would express that rebelliousness in some other fashion, but nevertheless it would express itself. Same thing if they tend to be kind. That kindness will be expressed one way in one culture and another way in another culture, etc. Okay. Now, language is the most important product of a culture. Every culture has one. That culture, that language grows out of that culture, is a fit expression for that culture, and all of the assumptions and values that are part of that culture. And language is, although it's a part of culture, it mirrors to a large extent all of the other features that I just talked about culture having. We acquire it as children just by listening to it. It is dynamic. It changes all the time. In fact, before too long, disenculturation will be a word. It's democratic. If you all use it enough, it will become a word. There are attempts to institutionalize it. Spell check. There are ways that culture tries to bring about uniformity and rules to language so that we can communicate with one another. Some cultures do that much more systematically and more rigorously than others. American culture doesn't do that very rigorously. French culture, they have bodies that determine what words are French and which ones are not. And they usually get it right. It's historically based. The language that we speak didn't come about out of nowhere. You can trace its history back. There's a reason why we have a lot of French words in the American language. There's a reason that we have a lot of Spanish words. And the further south you go, the more Spanish words there are. There's a reason why we have adopted words from a lot of different languages. All of that is historically explicable. And furthermore, language is well suited to the backcloth from which it arises. Language is how we organize our thoughts, and it tends to then influence the way we think about the world. If there is not a word in our language for a concept, it's hard for us to think of that concept as having validity. I'll pick on Russia again. There, at least when I was studying Russian in college, there was no Russian equivalent for the word efficiency. I'll let you guess as to why. And the last similarity, there's lots of room for individualization. Language is this convention, set of conventions that we all adopt in order to communicate with one another. But built into it is the flexibility that I can use language in my own idiosyncratic way to a certain extent and still communicate. That my personality can be expressed through the tools that are provided to me in language. So language is a product of culture, but it shares a lot of the same features of culture itself. And we can learn a lot about culture just by looking at language and how it works. Okay, I just want to make three observations about culture, and then I'm done. The first is that one can discover a lot about the backcloth of a society by examining the products of that society. The written words, the images, and the behaviors that are produced by that society or that culture tell you an enormous amount about the backcloth on which that culture rests. So how do you study a culture? You see what that culture does. You see what the people in that culture do and how they do it. Secondly, we are immersed in our own culture and therefore we are largely oblivious to it. It is generally easier to become aware of one's own culture by studying a different culture or by having someone from a different culture explain your culture to you. And the third observation I will make is that any product that is produced within a culture is assumed to be in conformity with that culture. As a result, it is difficult to speak into a culture in a way that challenges the assumptions of that culture. It becomes hard to communicate because they're going to want to interpret what you're saying in conformity with the kinds of messages that they typically hear in their culture, with words the way they're used to hearing them. And it becomes difficult to speak into a culture and say something that's counter to that culture. It will require a lot of explanation. It will not be easily understood, and it will be easily misunderstood. Okay, I'm done.